Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go back to November of 2016, the launch of Expedition 5051 from Kazakhstan to the International Space Station.
Be ready to land.
The engines igniting, the launch command issued. Again, the engines will fire, ramping up towards flight speed. And liftoff. Peggy Whitson, Oleg Novitsky, and Tomas Pesquet rocketing towards the International Space Station.
Well, astronauts on board included my guest this half hour. You heard her name there, native Iowan Peggy Whitson. She returned to Earth from that mission in September of 2017. Whitson has spent a total of 665 days in space during three long-duration missions. This total is more time in space than any other woman in the world and any other American, period. In 2008, she became the first woman to command the International Space Station. She joins us live this half hour. Peggy Whitson, what an honor to have you on the program. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you guys.
Tell us, you returned from those almost 290 days in space not too long ago. What were the biggest highlights of your latest mission?
Hard to pick any single day, but obviously spacewalks are always going to be a highlight, and I had four of those. But we were doing some really interesting science this time around, much more complex, more hands-on, required a little more technical skill. And so that, to me, was also a lot of fun on a more day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. In the research, you're a biochemist there. Were you active, setting up, looking after, maintaining experiments?
Yes. What's interesting, though, is you don't have to be a biochemist or any particular field of science, math, engineering, whatever. We have pilots and aerospace engineers, and so everyone is expected to be able to do science from any different field.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the most fun things were the tissue culture, because I had done that coincidentally, had done a lot of tissue culture after graduate school.
So you're growing tissues in space. Tissue.
Right. We were growing lung cancer cells, we were growing bone cells, cardiac cells, stem cells, looking at changes. One of the most interesting things were the lung cancer cells. We were doing a study looking at a drug conjugated to an antibody that would attack the cancer cells. And the reason we were using space is the cancer cells tend to form more like they would in your body. When you grow tissue on the ground, it tends to form a kind of two-dimensional structure instead of a three-dimensional structure like it would inside your body. And so spaceflight actually simulates that aspect of growing cell cultures better. And it gave us a platform to test out this new antibody drug conjugate, which would be great then because you could potentially attack cancer cells with a drug and not have to require such heavy doses like in the chemotherapies that we currently use today.
Peggy Whitson with us for approximately the next 20 minutes. If you have a question you'd like to ask our astronaut guest, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. What are the challenges? You've done this now three times. The challenges when you return to Earth, back to gravity, after a long period in space, what are the biggest challenges?
Well, gravity. Gravity, those first few weeks, is pretty stressful on the body. Your body has to remember how to work in gravity. And your mind will adapt to it and readjust, but just the physical effort initially, especially the first day, is just tremendous.
Right. We see astronauts, you, and we saw Scott Kelly return recently, being carried off of the recovery vehicle. You can walk, though, immediately after coming to Earth or not?
Yes, we can. It's just you don't feel very good while you're doing it initially. It tends to make you feel nauseous and like you're going to be sick.
Mm-hmm. So it's the same sort of thing in reverse that you get when you're initially in space, because you get sick then too, right?
A lot of people don't feel great when they first go into space, but some people feel better when they come back to Earth. And for me, going into space is not a problem, but coming home is definitely much harder to do.
Hmm. Daniel on our Facebook page asks you, Peggy, does it feel weird to eat and swallow in zero gravity?
Actually, it doesn't. It's surprising because you would think, well, maybe you wouldn't be able to swallow, but the muscles inside your esophagus and everything work in much more similar way as it does here on Earth. So there's no difficulty in swallowing liquids or eating food while on orbit.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned one of the highlights from your latest mission, the spacewalks. I think you've done 10 now, is that right, in your career?
That's correct.
They're called EVAs, extra vehicular activity. What is that experience like, to be floating outside the spacecraft instead of inside?
Well, it's pretty impressive. You know, if you think about the fact that we're traveling at 17,500 miles an hour, people tend to ask me, well, aren't you afraid of falling off? Well, I'm also traveling at 17,500 miles an hour in my own little space suit, which is basically like a little spaceship. It's got thermal control to keep me from being too hot when the sun's out and it's 270 degrees Celsius, or too cold when the sun is when we're behind the Earth, being shadowed by the Earth, and it's minus 270 degrees Celsius. So it protects me thermally. It removes the carbon dioxide from the air, and it provides oxygen. So it really is like a little spaceship. It's got ventilation, and the view can't be beat.
Mm-hmm. And you're going that fast, but in space there is no wind, right?
Nope, no wind to blow my hair.
Let's talk a little bit about growing up. You're originally from Beaconsfield in southern Iowa. I understand your parents own a farm?
Yes, they do.
And
my brother still farms down there, and I actually have some land down there too.
Mm-hmm. So growing up, when did you first know you might want to be an astronaut? Was it standing on a farm looking up, or dreaming of those Apollo missions that would have been in the 60s when you were growing up, in the 70s?
It was the Apollo missions. I remember we're watching as Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon for the very first time, thinking, wow, cool job. But I don't think, you know, when you're 9 years old, you know, there's lots of things you want to be. And I don't really think it became a goal of mine until I graduated from high school. And that was the year they picked the first female astronaut. And to me, that made it seem realistic and doable. So luckily, I had no idea how difficult it would be or how much competition there would be to get in. But after 10 years of applying, after I got my PhD, I finally made it.
So the window of opportunity opened just at the right time for you. Men, of course, initially the first astronauts. Is space, can you tell if space is better suited to men or women, or does it matter?
I don't honestly think it matters. However, I would say women tend to be a little more flexible, so maybe it's easier for us.
So flexible physically, or more like in interpersonal communication terms?
Interpersonal communications, adapting to new or difficult environments, that kind of thing.
Oh, really? So give us an idea of a typical day there on the space station. You have roughly how big is the space you're working with, just so we have an idea?
The space station, the living area, they say, is about equivalent to a four-bedroom house.
Mm-hmm.
It's spread out kind of linearly. We have modules off to the side, but mostly most of the volume is along a long, one long axis. Perpendicular to that axis on the outside, we have a truss that is the size of a football field. And it holds up the solar arrays, each of which there's 8 solar array wings, and each wing is 239 feet long. So it's amazingly big. And we built all of this by bringing up pieces on different vehicles, mostly on the shuttle, and we put them together in space. And then in some cases, they were never fit checked on the ground because they were being built all over the world. So it's pretty amazing that it has worked and that we were able to construct this engineering phenomena on orbit.
Mm-hmm. And you have been out in a spacewalk to repair, to work on it, right? So you get a different view of its enormity on the outside, repairing it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But considering even a 4 or 5 bedroom house, you know, if you think about how big that is, and then you think about, well, I can work on the walls, I can work on the ceiling, I can work on the floor. It really opens up a lot of volume and space to have experiments available in every direction, you know, because it's no problem in space. It's all zero gravity, and so every direction is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use the space much more efficiently than you could necessarily on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And in that 4-bedroom house, how many people are you sharing it with?
We have a total of 6 people. Most of the time I was up there with 6 people. We dropped down to 3 for a 2-month period, 2.5-month period.
Was that nice to have fewer people there?
It was fine. My previous expeditions were all 3-person crews, and so it doesn't bother me. I think some people like more social differences, you know, so you can interact with more people, but it really worked out great for the team that was up there at the time. No problem.
If you just joined us, my guest is astronaut Peggy Whitson. She spent more time in space than any other American. She's a native Iowan, and we have the pleasure of speaking with her this half hour. So is this space station quartered off into, is it all common space, or is there some space that you would have as private space?
We each have a personal space. It's our crew quarters where we have a sleeping bag and a computer desk. And I would compare it to the size of a telephone booth or a very small closet. But in space, that's actually pretty sufficient. It gives you enough room to put family pictures up on the wall and have your computer. Actually, we had 2 computers in there, so it was plenty of room.
Mm-hmm. So are there times when you just want your private space so that's respected? People don't bother you there?
Yeah, we have, you know, it's closed off doors, so it's actually very good soundproofing as well, so it's good to sleep in at night. You know, it's very comfortable. Has its own ventilation system.
Fina asks, what motivated you, Peggy, to become an astronaut, and what advice would you have for students who might want to follow in your footsteps?
I think the idea, you know, of seeing the astronauts walk on the moon was very inspirational to me, and seeing the reality that women were doing it made it seem realistic to me. So I think that's what motivated me, was the fact that, hey, this looks like, you know, being a part of exploration looked really exciting and cool. And that's, I think, where my motivation was.
Mm-hmm. And advice for those who might want to do, young men or women who might want to follow in your footsteps?
Absolutely. So number one is you have to find your passion. And I mentioned before that any field in science, math, engineering, technology is applicable to being a part of space exploration. And so find your passion. That's important. You want to be really good at whatever it is that you do. And much of the path to becoming an astronaut is a journey to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to love what you're doing and love what you're working on and be good at it.
Sounds like
the second thing,
have tenacity. You took a long time and didn't give up.
That's right. There's thousands of applicants. For instance, on the last application round, we had 18,000 applicants for 12 positions. So definitely a lot of competition, and it needs to be, what you're working on needs to be a passion. So that work hard and that passion, and then the thing that I think has made me most successful is being able to push myself, challenge myself, to live a little bit and to try things a little bit outside my comfort zone. In other words, you know, I never dreamed of being chief of the astronaut office, but I was provided an opportunity to take on more of a leadership role, and that was a little challenging for me, not having a lot of experience in that area, but I tried that, and then after my second space flight, I became the chief of the astronaut office, and all of that is even more than I would ever have dreamed of, mm-hmm. and it was because I challenged myself to do more than I might have thought I could.
In 2008, you became the first woman to command the International Space Station. What does that entail, being the commander up there?
The command role is primary responsibility is the safety of the crew, the safety of the vehicle. But on a day-to-day basis, you know, we're all working together. We're all one team. We're all trying to get the jobs, the various jobs that the ground has assigned us done on a given day. And what that amounts to is, you know, making sure we're helping each other, making sure all the tasks are getting done, making sure everyone's staying safe while they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. What does it smell like on the International Space Station? Is it are smells different?
Actually, no, the smells are the same, but, you know, people, I think, assume it's got a stink up there, and it really doesn't. Our ventilation systems, you know, we have HEPA filters to clean the air and great ventilation systems. You know, things are very different in space. We have things floating in the air, you know, debris and dust that would fall to the floor here on the ground is actually going to be in the air. So we need strong enough ventilation systems to clean that out. But there's always going to be a little bit more stuff than, you know, you have here on Earth, of course, because it is floating. One of the things I always tell people is that the air quality usually goes down after about 2 months when the calluses on your feet start coming off because you're not walking on your feet anymore. So you lose the calluses on the bottom of your feet. So the air quality goes down there for a little while.
Okay. I'm trying to figure that one out. Many of our listeners would have heard a recent interview with Scott Kelly. You were up there with him for some time?
No, I was not.
Okay.
Came back before I got up there.
But he was talking about how, and this is not anything new, but that urine is recycled to drinking water. Is that hard to take your first swallow of that, or does that work?
It works just fine. Actually, it's, I think, one of the great technologies that we're testing out. In order for us to go on exploration missions, you know, or even have, like, permanent residences on the moon or Mars or any other place distant from Earth, we are going to have to be able to recycle as much water as possible because water is heavy and we can't carry enough water to support human beings, very many human beings, without it being just a huge, huge expense. So on board the space station, we now at around 80 to 85% of our water is recycled from urine and sweat and condensate from your breath. So it's a great system, you know, obviously for future exploration missions, we want to get even closer to that 100% level, but we've really done a great job, I think, of getting in there, improving some technology, proving what works, what doesn't work, what breaks, what we need to try and do differently in the next versions.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, when you were launched, it was 2016, Barack Obama was the president. When you returned, Donald Trump was the president, and we've had a very tumultuous political year here in the United States. Did that get talked about there on the International Space Station with your Russian colleagues?
Well, I think in general, we don't talk about politics in the sense that where it would be something stressful. We are all respectful of our respective countries. We are all there representing each of our countries. And we want to preserve that peace and that camaraderie, that professional relationship that we have that enables us to get the job done. I think that the International Space Station's legacy will be the fact that we are demonstrating how to do very complex tasks in an international environment. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy, trivial, because of other politics on the ground. But for the most part, we get to isolate ourselves from that politics and be the team that's making, you know, the space station work.
I know you have to go. One last question. Looking forward to, since you've endured so many days, 665 days in space, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing humans when we spend ever longer periods of time in space?
I think spending time in space is going to be a lot more difficult when we're outside the magnetosphere of Earth. Earth's magnetosphere protects us from a lot of the radiation that we would get on board the space station. It's higher radiation than we have here on Earth, but it's still much less than it would be if we were traveling in deep space. So I think radiation is going to be an issue in the future. We're continuously learning more and more things about being in space for long duration periods of time, which is why we're doing the research that we are doing up there. For instance, we found that there are changes in vision. Some of them can be permanent changes. And so we're trying to understand, you know, what's the meaning of that and what are the impacts for future explorers.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Astronaut Peggy Whitson, native Iowan. We're so proud of you here in Iowa. All that you've achieved. Peggy Whitson, thank you so much. What an honor.
Well, proud to be from Iowa.
All right, then. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's end this segment with a little bit of audio from a video tribute to Peggy Whitson when she was named 2017 Glamour Woman of the Year.
I never dreamed of being chief of the astronaut office, but I made it because I continued to challenge myself to do more than I thought I could. I think it was something that was always a dream of mine, but I would say that year after I graduated from high school, it became a goal. Luckily, I had no idea how hard it would be to get selected.
I read that it took you 10 years of trying to be admitted into the astronaut training program.
That is correct. I started applying as soon as I had my PhD, and then later was lucky enough to be selected in the position of being an astronaut. I remember on my first flight, one morning I woke up and I was floating across the lab and I'm like, I'm an astronaut doing research in space.
The record-setting astronaut Peggy Whitson is heading home. Having spent 665 days in orbit over the course of her career, she now holds the record for the most time in space of any American.
What makes the best astronaut is somebody with good interpersonal skills. Somebody that understands how to manage themselves and do the things that you need to do to be professional and reach out to others, to be a part of a team. I had so many expectations of what I thought it would be, and all of my expectations were exceeded. Being above the Earth and looking at the Earth, we had a really fantastic appreciation of.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, keeping up with our space theme today, we're going to spend the rest of the hour listening back to parts of two conversations I've had with former astronaut and current Iowa State University faculty member Clayton Anderson. I first spoke with Anderson in 2014 when he began teaching ISU students about the operational aspects of spaceflight training. It included scuba certification, wilderness survival, skydiving, flight simulation, and a virtual visit to the International Space Station. Anderson has been to the actual space station orbiting the Earth twice.
Okay, so the activities that I named there, how do they relate to the operational aspects of spaceflight training? I mean, some of them are obvious, flight simulation, but others, scuba, wilderness survival?
Right. The whole idea here is that operational thinking astronauts are better astronauts. Operational thinking engineers, I believe, are better engineers. And so the idea here was to take experiences that I had received as an astronaut in training that made me begin to think and act more operationally and to provide that same impetus to the students. And some of those activities are things like scuba diving when you're in a very extreme environment where following procedures and making sure your equipment is operationally functional can save your life. And in addition to that, we're going to do skydiving, which is another similar event that helps you think more operationally. And when we threw them in the simulator this morning, the virtual simulator of the space station, and created a fire on board and filled the station with smoke and then asked them to react to it based on some rudimentary procedures we provided, it was pretty obvious that their stress level went up quickly.
Oh, I would imagine. Were you happy with their reaction?
Absolutely. You know, we have to scale this down a lot, obviously. But their abilities and their reactions to the situation were actually quite good. So we're very pleased with what they did today. And all the activities are designed to be extremely exciting and interesting for the students and a little outside the box.
Mm-hmm. So define this a little bit more, operational thinking. What does it mean to think like an astronaut?
Well, the example I try to use, and I'm not sure yet if it's a good one, but imagine a hotel in space is being designed. And the company doing that design wants to hire Iowa State University graduates. When you imagine using that hotel and that hotel's bathroom for the very first time, and you are not a professionally trained astronaut, that bathroom in the hotel needs to be as intuitive and designed to be as easily functionable as possible by a layperson, if you will. And so if these students are more trained in thinking operationally, they'll think like the operator that's going to have to use that bathroom in that hotel in space. They will hopefully then make a more effective, a more intuitive, and a simpler design that will allow people to not have to undergo a boatload of training to be able to experience spaceflight.
So this workshop is a prototype, and you hope to grow it into what, a minor or a major at ISU?
Well, I think we need to walk before we run, but my goal would be to have an academic process through which the kids could both receive credit and perhaps even a minor degree or a certificate, they call it at Iowa State, such that there's a clear documentation of the extra activities that they participated in so that employers can see that. We do a great job with fundamental education here at ISU in the engineering department, but adding this operational training for these kids, I hope, will set them apart from other institutions. And in order to do that effectively, I think we'll need something that provides the credit for them, perhaps as a minor degree in spaceflight operations.
What is your vision? You talked about a hotel in space, but your vision overall in the future of this commercialization of space and the employment that it will provide?
Mm-hmm. Well, imagine Orville and Wilbur on the beaches in Kitty Hawk in 1903. They had no idea that their invention was going to lead to worldwide air travel, where people today simply climb on an airplane and go to their seat in business class or in coach, and they know exactly what to do. They know where the bathrooms are, how to function there. They know how to pull out the tray table and deal with the oxygen mask. You know, it's all intuitive to them because of a good operational design. But that operational design was not learned instantaneously. It was developed over time. And I think we're going to have a lot of quote-unquote everyday people that in the future, I hope, will have an opportunity to experience space in much the same way that I did. And our ability to design these future craft, these future housing entities in space, will go a long way in how good of an experience people will have when they actually are able to do it. So while commercial companies are feeling their way right now and the International Space Station is still sailing overhead, there's lots of work going on out there to create the next generation of I'll say, tourist attractions in outer space. I may be thinking too far ahead, but we want to help prepare our students to be more ready to be a part of that workforce that designs all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that hotel in space, when can we make reservations? And more importantly, what will the jacuzzi in my room look like, Clayton Anderson? That water's going to be all over the place.
Well, you know, it might not be a jacuzzi. It might be a holodeck, like on the Starship Enterprise.
Okay, I'd
you
settle for that.
You never know.
That was part of my conversation with retired astronaut Clayton Anderson from 2014, when he first started teaching at Iowa State University. Anderson is a distinguished faculty fellow in aerospace engineering at ISU. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I also spoke with Clay Anderson in 2015, and this time it was shortly after the release of the movie The Martian. Here I talk with Clay about his reaction to the film, whether it was realistic, and how far we are today from the goal of landing humans on the red planet. Now, you have done some incredible things in space, Clayton Anderson, nearly 40 hours spacewalking in a suit, as we saw in the latest movie, The Martian. You've completed 5 months aboard the space station in 2007. I wonder if we can start with you to get reaction to The Martian as a movie. You actually went to see a special viewing of the film, special invitees?
Right. We were in Houston, and NASA actually participated with Ridley Scott to provide technical support in the development and the making of the movie, which is hugely important for those of us who have actually done it. And as part of that, Fox was gracious enough to allow many NASA engineers, scientists, astronauts, administrative folk into the theater to see a couple private screenings. So that's when I saw The Martian for the first time.
Talk about a tough audience to please. All kinds of astrophysics expertise there in that audience. So, let me ask you, Clay, what did you think of the film overall? What stood out for you?
Well, I was asked to write a review by Quartz.com, which you can find on my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed, under Astro_Clay or Astro Clay. And I would say it's a very entertaining film. Of course, there are technical issues that folks at the Johnson Space Center might giggle and snicker a little bit at.
For instance?
Well, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but okay. Suffice it to say that spacewalks should require a tether. But, you know, for the most part, it was very well done. And my take from the movie was that for a person who spent his 30-year career working within NASA and the Johnson Space Center in roles that included both an aerospace engineer and then ultimately an astronaut, I was very pleased with the way they portrayed NASA's can-do attitude and we will do whatever it takes to save this mission. In addition, a nice treat was the work between the Jet Propulsion Lab, which is noted for its unmanned programs, and the Johnson Space Center and the Kennedy Space Center, noted for their manned programs, as they paired up and worked together to save the day. And then a third aspect was the use of a foreign entity to help them complete the mission that I think bodes well for the future. So without giving away too much, I think it was a well-done film. I was entertained. Yes, I snickered a few times. Neil deGrasse Tyson will snicker multiple times and probably write 1,000 tweets, much like he did with the movie Gravity. But if I were to recommend a movie to see, I would recommend this one. And I absolutely love Matt Damon and his irreverent attitude because he's very much like the ordinary spaceman.
Really? That attitude is found in astronauts, test
pilots?
No. No, it's not.
No. It was found in yours truly, and much to the chagrin of many in the control center. So typically, astronauts do not behave as a Matt Damon behaved in that movie.
But Clayton Anderson did up there when you spent 160-some days in space and had these space flights?
Yes, and I paid for it with...
For instance, what would be irreverent when you think back? Do you want to share an experience?
When you live in a can in outer space, whether it be soaring about the Earth or on the red planet's surface, and the ground asks you to do something that is silly or, from your perspective, unnecessary, The tendency can be for someone who's been stranded there, like Mark Watney, for a long time, to give a smart aleck comment back. And I was prone to that, and it was frowned upon. So astronauts are sometimes expected to play a game where they are to communicate appropriately and smile a lot as they deal with the ground control team. It's a frustrating thing. It was a very frustrating thing for me in space. And I think some of that was portrayed by Watney in the movie. And many have come to me and said that Watney reminds them of me, so as an astronaut. So I'll just let it go at that.
Clay, as someone who's spent many, many days in space, in the space station, circling the Earth, did you feel pride here at any moments, watching what was happening on screen?
I think certainly as I'd mentioned, this ability of family members, fathers, mothers, uncles, aunts that work within the space program to throw aside everything that's dear to them to concentrate on their work and focus on saving the life of Mark Watney or the Apollo 13 crew is indeed prideful for all Americans. And I think that's the premise of the film that touches most of the people's hearts, is that if there is a disaster of any type, most humans on this planet rally to support and help and save those people who have been hit with this disaster. I think that's human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part that I'm very proud of, and that I'm very proud to have been a part of. And we need more of that. We need more of that throughout the Earth and throughout our solar system. But that's what struck me in the movie. And in real life, you know, the unmanned programs often fight with the human programs for funding, for priority, for experiments, for notoriety. And in the movie, it was not portrayed that way. And that's another thing I think we could do better is, as a NASA entity, is not be siloed institutions, be united institutions. And I think for a large part we are, but in certain aspects there are some unmanned or some robotic folks who argue with the human aspect of spaceflight. And it comes down mostly to money and resources.
Mm-hmm. There's one line that really stood out for me, an exchange of two lines, and I wondered what you thought about this, Clay. The director of NASA in the film says, "It's not about one man." And the Sean Bean character, if I'm correctly quoting him, says, "Yes, it is." How did you interpret that moment, if you remember it?
Well, I do remember that moment, and there's always management. I guess it would be much akin to when the United States is in a military conflict. The folks in the trenches, they do believe it is about one human, one life, whereas the field generals and the administrators who have placed us in harm's way, they think at a bigger level, at a bigger picture. And sometimes one person's sacrifice is, I hate the term, but I'll have to use collateral damage maybe, but I do believe that at NASA, when you get right down to it, it would be about that life. It would be about bringing them back safely.
Clayton Anderson with us, former NASA astronaut, as we contemplate Mars and then possible manned mission to Mars in the future. Clayton Anderson, where are we in that venture, that possible manned mission?
We're quite a ways away, I think. They tout that we'll send humans to Mars sometime in the 2030s time frame. I, for one, think that the logical step is to put a base on the moon first. And I say that because we know that there's water there now, and we tout that we can split the water into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can make rocket fuel and various things like that. And I believe that that's all true. But what I don't believe is that we know how we're going to do that. We don't know how we're going to get into the soil and dig it up and process it and then store it. You know, the Martian movie shows all that being done already, but I don't think we have that technology. So I'm an advocate to first go do it on the moon, which is only 3 days away, which has no communication delay. which provides us with the ability to send equipment there and test it out and then perhaps learn from it such that as we do parallel development to go to the red planet, then we have this lunar base where we're testing our things. Now, all of this requires money, as we've talked about, but I believe that it's not the destination that you choose. It's what you learn along the way and the technology development that happens as you push toward the moon or toward an asteroid or toward Mars. And that's what will ultimately benefit the humans back on Earth. So I think space is an investment for people. It's just hard when you throw out tens of hundreds of billions of dollars. People can't grab onto that. They think it's, you know, a lot of money being thrown at a target that doesn't help them.
Mm-hmm. And right, that would be one of the battles that would have to be fought. Would this mission ever get off the ground? Is it has to be justified when, as when we had the Apollo missions, there's so much need, suffering, and misery on the Earth. Why do this? And Clayton, your answer is?
My answer is as you go out in the backyard and you pop your portable battery into your portable drill and work on your fence, and then you finish that project and you head to Vail, Colorado to ski down the mountain and you squirt anti-fog into your goggles. And along the way to Vail, Colorado, you drive on a curved surface on Interstate 80 that allows you to have a safer transit in rainy and snowy weather. And as farmers in Iowa have an artificial sow that allows all of the piglets that come from the mother to survive rather than just a portion of her piglets, all of those things have their birth in NASA technology and in taxpayer investment dollars. So those are things that have come back from the investment in their space program, and that's why I believe in what we do, and I believe it's important. Not necessarily that we want to put a human footprint on the red surface of Mars.
Clayton Anderson with us, retired NASA astronaut, now on the faculty of Iowa State University, spent 5 months aboard the International Space Station before retiring. Clay Anderson, do we belong in space? Shouldn't we do this at much less cost with a greater yield of scientific results, findings at a lower cost?
As an astronaut who did 6 spacewalks, if there is a robotic capability that can go out and do some of the jobs that I did, such that I don't have to risk my life to do that job, it's probably going to be a little bit cheaper in the long run. But today we have robots on the space station that are supposed to do exactly that. One of them is inside and has yet to go outside and struggles to pull a Kleenex out of a box. Another robot outside that's also designed to do that. At this point in our technology development, it takes almost 4 times the amount of hours, user hours, and it has to be driven by people on the ground to do the same thing a suited astronaut could do in one spacewalk. So we're learning all the time, and the two, unmanned and manned, have to go in tandem to me. To send things to Mars, look at all the things that we're learning such that if we do send humans to Mars eventually, we're going to be way smarter as to where we should put that base of humans to keep them safe, to get the maximum science return, to have a human being be able to look and interpret and perhaps change the experiment in real time to enhance the amount of data that we receive. And if I can throw one last thing in here, you know,
Clay, yeah, sure.
I did write a book called The Ordinary Spaceman, and while I am doing a shameless plug, I want to point out that the title of The Ordinary Spaceman is very important to me and to young people, at least in the Midwest. I was just an ordinary kid who, with the help of people who, of my family, my friends, my educators, my coaches, all those folks, helped to mold me into someone who was able to do some extraordinary things. And that is what I believe is the human condition, right? Most people are simply humans, but with the extra effort, the activity that goes into it, and with us collaborating together rather than against one another, we can do some extraordinary things. And that is a premise that I would love to have every human being on Earth grab a hold of.
That was some of my conversation from 2015, right after the release of the movie The Martian, with retired astronaut Clayton Anderson, who is a faculty member at Iowa State University. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins.
Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. And the loud sound that seemed to fight came back like a slow voice on a wave of fight. That was no DJ, that was Hazy Cosmic Jive. There's a star. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks